Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to the 2017 Healthcare Business Women's Association podcast series. My name is Julie Kelly, and I'm an HBA volunteer, as we call it, and your host for this Blog Talk Radio show. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with the HBA is a global nonprofit organization comprised of individuals and organizations from across the healthcare industry committed to achieving gender parity in leadership positions, facilitating career and business connections, and providing effective practices that enable organizations to realize the full potential of their female talent. Now, our program series titled Career Transitions, Moving from A to Z with Success and Purpose, supports this mission by exploring real career journeys and sharing key learnings from our HBA members. And our discussion today is titled From Bench to Business, The Journey of the Scientist. And today I have the pleasure of exploring this topic with two outstanding long-term HBA volunteer leaders, Dr. Jean Chow and Dr. Linda Brock. The doctors are in the house tonight. Welcome, Jean and Linda.
Thank you, Julie.
Yeah. So, Jean, why don't you open up and can tell us a bit about yourself before we get into this topic?
Sure, and thank you very much for the invitation to talk about this very exciting topic. I am a physician, and I started my training in the Sophie Davis program at City College, which was a very intensive program, which was 4 years of college and 2 years of medical school, where the first 2 years of medical school, all the basic sciences was spread out through the 4 years of college. So it was very accelerated and very intense. And from there, we went to do your internship. And my training was in a fellowship called Pediatrics Infectious Disease and HIV. And I did my fellowship at New York Medical College and Lincoln Hospital in the South Bronx. So I saw a lot of HIV patients at that particular time, and a lot of it was going through a very difficult period in America history. And then from there on, I sort of just by chance, I stumbled upon an invite from somebody who I thought was doing a clinical trial, and it turned out to be a headhunter. I did not know that they were headhunters. I mean, so this very nice woman, Ina Bauman, I still remember her name, introduced me to a company at that time called Lilly or American Cyanamid, and they were doing clinical trials in children and pediatrics. And then from there, you go into business where, they had a merger, a hostile takeover. And from there, I went in, apparently was taken over by American Home Products, and I said it was very business is cutthroat. So I said I'm going back to academics, and then an opportunity was offered at Pfizer, and so I've been at Pfizer now for actually 21 years. My anniversary came up, and at Pfizer I've done clinical trials, and I presently work for the Pfizer's worldwide regulatory and safety operations, where we do ensure regulatory compliance and pharmacovigilance. And I stumbled upon HBA like everything else I do in life, stumbling upon it, where I was interested in, someone spoke about a mentor-mentoree program. And at that time, I was involved with diversity and inclusion at Pfizer. And I got involved with mentoring program where I was the mentor, and it was one of the best experiences in my life. And and HBA provides an opportunity for volunteering, for giving back, and also for networking.
Well, and we have certainly benefited from your expertise and from your leadership. So thank you for everything you do for the HBA. But you know, what a transition! What a career that you've had, starting at the bench and going to business. And we'll talk a little bit more about some of those challenges after we meet Miss Linda, who's going to tell us a bit about herself. So, Dr. Linda, share.
Well, I'd like to echo Jean's comment for thank you, Julie, for having us on our podcast today. I'm very excited to talk to you about kind of that transition from bench to business. I'm going to talk about two things. First, just a little bit about myself, but then also as a leader of the HBA Women in Science Affinity Group, and I'll come back to that. But I earned my bachelor's degree from College of the Ozarks in near Springfield, Missouri, in biology and chemistry, and I actually had started off wanting to go to medical school when I went to college. And, you know, thinking about kind of just growing up in a rural area and going to college and interested in science, so what are your choices, a doctor or a nurse? That was kind of, I remember at that time thinking, you know, I could count them on one hand. And then as I got to college and did some summer research experiences, I really found out that I really enjoyed research, and that's what I wanted to do. And so I went on to get my doctorate in immunology and then later do a postdoctoral training in vaccine development. So a lot of my publications and patents are in infectious diseases and vaccine development. And currently, though, one thing I've done on the side that has really meant a lot to me is leading within the HBA, the Women in Science Affinity Group. I started out being a member of the team and then leading one of the chapter groups, and now I'm in a role where I'm the Global Committee Chair for Women in Science Affinity Group. And it's the group is growing, first of all. We started the year with about six groups, and now we've doubled that. And I'm proud that we're going to be in every region under the new HBA model. And the HBA Women in Science Group focuses on helping support women scientists in the pharmaceutical sector of healthcare and helping them through their career by providing programs and resources for its members.
Right, and it's certainly needed, and thank you for your leadership and all the time that you've contributed to the HBA and in the WISC group, because our women in science certainly need support. It's a very different type of job, and, you know, I learned more about it when my son went back to get his PhD. I really had very little knowledge about PhDs. No one in my family really pursued one, but I grew to really appreciate all the work that goes into those people that start at the bench and start with discovery of our medicine. But, you know, let's let Linda share a little bit more about the life of a scientist. You're coming right out of your postdoc. Tell us about, you know, what is the life like for someone going back to school and doing research?
Well, I definitely would agree that it's a different career track, and I'll say that from this standpoint, that if you go to get a master's degree, let's say an MBA, or if you go to get a doctorate, maybe an MD or a JD, those degrees are very clear cut. So you attend these courses, you pass these exams, you get this degree. With a master's in biomedical research or a PhD, there is formal coursework at the beginning, but a lot of it depends upon you creating enough research that signifies a publication, a first author publication, and then a committee that basically kind of says, okay, you've created sufficient amount of work to earn your doctorate. So it's very gray, and there's problems that can come up. You could be a part of a group that loses funding. So maybe a key piece of your research that makes it publishable is no longer a part of the budget. You could be with a mentor perhaps within their group that changes universities. They make a move. So now you have to help, you know, you have to make the decision whether you perhaps try to start that project under a new mentor or, you know, move and uproot and go with the new faculty and institution that your mentor is moving to. Or, you know, there's relationship skills there too. in regards to a committee signing off on, you know, graduating. So there's a lot of factors.
A lot of factors. It's not cut and dry. I remember our son saying, well, I'll be in school either 4 or 5 years. We're like, what? Which?
Right.
and that's when I really grew to appreciate that, you know, his work was, you know, go in, discover, you know, head down, do the experiment, you know, fail, and then rinse and repeat. And that's constant that you're trying to, you know, to continue until you find success in publication rules. Getting published is the goal, right? It's like that.
Right. Publish
that's
or perish.
That's the measure of success. Publish or perish, right? So that it's very unique in terms of education. And like you said, that gray is very scary. But not only that, you know, the way this whole funding, this is what is so interesting to me, is that how do PhDs get funding? Because we know that that really impacts, like you said, the success, right, of your experience and as a postdoc, and, you know, how much money you're going to have to be able to continue the research to get to what, you know, what you're trying to prove. And there's this article that, Linda, you brought to my attention. It was by Heidi Lederford. It was published in June 29th of this year in Nature. It was titled, U.S. Postdocs Face Challenges When Starting Families. And it notes that, Ms. Lederford notes that researchers from ethnic minorities are more likely to be discouraged from taking parental leave. I was surprised to learn the inequities faced by some of these scientists when starting a family. And this is all around how PhD programs are funded and why this is so. So, Linda, can you kind of summarize that article for us and why there be some issues for our women and men and scientists starting families?
Okay. So, first of all, they did a survey of 741 postdoc researchers, and what they found was that their ability to take time off, mother or father, after a birth or adoption, widely depended on the funding source. And just speaking from experience, so a postdoc typically is not a full-time employee. It's categorized in some spaces as a trainee or a contractor or and a graduate student as well. So, like, there isn't, you're not coming into a permanent position because it's short term. So, therefore, they don't usually come with benefits, and that could include health care benefits, retirement, et cetera. And so, in this particular study, what they found was that although there were difficulties for all groups, they found it more difficult for particular ethnic minorities. And 20% of the Asian respondents and 17% of the participants from other minority groups said that even their mentors discouraged leave. So it becomes quite difficult if, A, the benefits aren't already established with the role, but then if you have internal pressure to not take time off, it really does create problems, especially since the majority of the people in these programs are, you know, at a time in their life where they may be thinking of starting a family.
Exactly. So there's so much around the funding. You're working off grant money most of the time. So this, they're not building in extra dollars for people to take family leave or from the bench. So that's really truly the issue there. And that while some of the programs do allow it, and they have built it into the funding, for the most part, it's really not there. And that's likely why people are discouraged from taking family leave during the research period. Does that sound correct to you, basically, what's going on?
Yeah.
Okay, yep. So, Jean, what's your reaction to this article? What kind of experience have you had?
Well, I'm not surprised by all the findings of the article. I mean, myself, for example, after having my first child going in for her visit, I recall being seen by one of the attending. He was a cardiologist who kind of looked at me and said hello and had greetings, and then noticed my baby and said, "So you have yes, my baby." Very excited. And so, when are you going back to work? And I was like, "Well, I haven't decided yet." And it was like, "Well, what he said was very disparaging, which was so what a waste of your education." And I was kind of shocked by that. But you kind of remember those kind of periods.
Yeah.
Another period that I remember was taking my daughter. You're rushing. You're always, you know, doing my fellowship. This was my fellowship in South Bronx, and just rushing around, just doing, taking care of the kids. And Jennifer was a first grader, and I remember a mother coming over to me and says, "You must be so proud of your daughter." And I said, "Why?" "She's tutoring my Jennifer." And I got into my car, and I just sat there, and I started crying, because it was like you felt like, you know, you weren't giving enough time to your children. And when your child is on autopilot, you're just so relieved that, you know, you're doing something, you know, something is working out. You don't know how you're doing it, but you do it. No one gives you a book on how to, you know, have a career and have a child at the, you know, children and everything. So, you know, the findings of the article, of the poster that we looked at, does not surprise me at all.
Right. So the poster we're referencing is a poster that was presented at the recent HBA annual conference. And it's titled, "Beakers or Babies, Work-Life Balance Among Women in STEM." And we had some young researchers from the University of Las Vegas, Nevada, to talk about some of the challenges for women going into STEM. We got to get more women into STEM, but you know, there are a lot of challenges that women in STEM have to deal with. So Linda, do you want to summarize kind of the finding in this poster?
Yeah, so first of all, I just want to congratulate the authors on their very creative title. I heard that or read that, and I just laughed out loud. And I thought,
because we know
wow,
what it meant, right? You knew exactly
yeah.
what it meant.
And I thought they really captured it. So hats off to the authors. But they looked at a survey of 156 women from graduate to undergraduate. And basically they found a lot about what we are talking about on this show, which is how early career women in STEM are more likely to have kind of an internal conflict with respect to balancing work-life culture and, you know, having concerns about, you know, do I need to choose between a STEM and career or a family? And that perceived worry, and just basically they documented it and showed that, you know, this really is real.
That it's real. I think, Linda, you might have gone on mute accidentally. But it was all around beakers and babies, that either women that are contemplating careers in STEM are challenged. And, you know, there is kind of a split group. The majority of the women are saying that it's going to be difficult to balance this, and they make certain decisions based on the ability to balance in terms of what they're going to pursue in STEM. And so, you know, even with today's young up-and-coming women in STEM, they realize that there's some inequities and challenges with going into a career in STEM. So, you know, these kind of this whole career life balance, and I would say in addition to that, can kind of the negative attitudes in the workplace, you know, between personal and professional, it continues to prevail, but it's not just in STEM areas. But Jean, you shared with us an excerpt from a book by Ellen Pao in the August 21st, 2017 issue of the New York Magazine. It was titled, "This is How Sexism Works in Silicon Valley. My Lawsuit Failed, Others Won't." And Ellen's an investment banker who sat on a company's board, and she sued her employer over workplace discrimination and loss. And I just want to read one piece of an article where she speaks to having a family, which kind of supports what we're talking about. And here it goes, quote, "Of the few women I encountered at or above my professional level, almost none had young families. One partner told me that when she happily announced her third pregnancy, a male senior partner responded, 'I don't know any professional working woman who has three kids.' When I gave birth to my first child, some partners at work treated my taking maternity leave as equivalent of abandoning a ship in the middle of a typhoon." She goes on and on and on. And luckily, someone coached her into how to manage that and how to downplay her maternity leave and try to work to maintain her client base. So, Jean, tossing that back to you, because I think it goes on to talk about, you know, some other issues in the workplace. Did you want to comment on that?
Yes. I mean, isn't it surprising that we're having this discussion in this day and age in 2017? I mean, the book, yes, it was in August 21st of 2017, yes. That this is still, people yes. are still talking about, you know, the fact that they have to have children, you know, have a pregnancy. And it was very interesting also that part of at the end she talked to other people who have sued after her lawsuit, and she mentions that Whitney Wolf, who's the co-founder of Tinder, was had sued because of sexual harassment. And this, of course, is a topic that is right now in our face on through the media, and all it takes is one person to come out and the whole floodgate open. I think a lot of this has to do with our social media and the technology of how information is getting around. So I think you know, there are a lot of challenges still, and that's the shame of it.
Right, and again, that could be a whole program in and of itself, but in addition to being able to balance work and family life, then we have to deal with sexism in the workplace. So, again, we'll continue that in 2018. But you know, there are challenges there, and you know, especially, you know, for not just for people, women in STEM, but women in the workplace overall.
Right.
So, Linda, did you want to comment?
Yes, I just... I just wanted to kind of echo what's being said, that I think, first of all, it's, you know, congratulations and hats off to the women who are coming forward. And, you know, it's not easy in a workplace by any means to, you know, to stand up and voice what happened. But knowing that you're putting a stake in the ground for the generations behind you to make things better. So,
yeah.
In those aspects, it's great.
Right.
I agree. Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So, Jean, with, you know, all the challenges that you faced, how did you prepare for all the transitions that you made in your career to get to the bench, to the business world? Because, you know, scientists and business people think differently. So can you elaborate on that and kind of share a little bit more about
sure.
how you prepared to make those transitions?
There is no preparation in transition into biopharma. There's
okay,
absolutely none at all. From exactly, we could stop the talk now. But I think it's the reason for that is, and this Linda and I, you know, talk about a lot, is because as scientists, we're free thinkers, and it does not fit into the mold of corporate America. It's changing, but changing very slowly. So I think how I was able to navigate the different jobs and positions that I have is trying to be flexible. And I never had a mentor or a sponsor, but I did find people, male and female, who I can talk to about what was I supposed to do in this new position that I have in corporate America. And there were many times that I made mistakes. And you realize that that was normal. No patient died that, you know, when you were doing the work you were doing in corporate America, thank God.
Right.
But it was
right.
a different kind of stress and different kind of timelines and all these things that that you do not have to deal with as a physician. So the stresses are in a different particular area, and you just have to kind of learn the rules as they go along. And I'm still learning the rules.
Right.
And
Jean,
yes.
reflectively, what do you think could have helped you? You talked about having mentors. You think formal mentors? What do you think could have helped you more?
I think if I had a program like HBA, I think would have been great. And I've met a lot of young women through HBA, and I think if you had a program like that in the beginning that talked about having mentors, that talked about what sponsorship is, that would have been great. In our time, we never had that kind of that was not in our vocabulary. Now it is.
Yes.
And I think something like that would have been very instrumental. So what I do now is I try to, within my group, my Women in Science Affinity group, we do try to mentor, and women are in transition constantly, and I give them a forum. For a while there, I had like three women who were looking and seeking jobs. I had them have a forum, like meet at 5 p.m. to see how the day went. How was your, looking for a job? How did that go? And just to give people a forum where they can talk and discuss and like-minded women. And
share interests, share experiences.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
And insight.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
So when Linda, fresh out of the doc, postdoc, how do you think we can better support women to be successful in STEM and STEM careers?
So first of all, I would recommend to every woman who's interested in STEM or in a STEM career to have your own set circle of mentors. And keep them varied, too. I think sometimes people think, well, if I want to be the investigator in academia, my mentor should just look like that, an investigator in academia. I think you need those, but I would also keep your options open. The positions in science are limited, and so you kind of never know where things are going to take you. And I would recommend, to have perhaps a mentor who is highly successful in another sector of STEM, so to speak, or, perhaps someone who's a medical director at a company. You might think, oh, well, that's not my career path, so that may not be the best mentor for me. But I think having mentors from very different sectors, different levels of career are important.
Absolutely. I think your own board of advisors, that can bring insight from a variety of different areas that you'll have to navigate when you make a transition from the bench to business. It's not intuitive. So I think today this conversation has been really, really interesting, and this half hour has gone very quickly. So we're going to continue to explore career transitions. Those of you that enjoy the HBA webinars on Tuesday, we're having a webinar on career transitions, and I will be on that program sharing the insights I learned from all these lovely HBA members such as Jean and Linda. So I want to thank you both for sharing your story and your insight today. And
thank
I look
you,
forward
Julie.
To you're very welcome. You're very welcome, and for all your volunteer work with the HBA, thank you for your leadership. And I hope that you all will join the webinar on career transitions, moving through your career with purpose and grace, and that will be on Tuesday, December 5th. So, again, thank you,
perfect.
And this is Julie Kelly, and we're signing off here for the HBA.
Bye,
thank
everyone.
You.
Happy holidays.